A big new development deal for Lot J. The battle over a half-cent sales tax for schools wages on. And a slew of public officials in the headlines for all the wrong reasons. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. And just ahead this Friday, all of the top stories of the week with our media roundtable. You can get on the line now. It's 549-2937. Join us. Then later in the hour, some financial ABCs for our students heading off to college in the next few weeks. All of that and more just ahead. But first this hour, it's Friday. And my goodness, has it been a busy week in the news. Lots to talk about as we welcome Dan Scanlon of the Florida Times-Union. Good morning.
Good morning.
Ann Schindler of First Coast News is here.
Hey, Melissa.
Hey. Giorgio Valentino, editor at Folio Weekly.
Good morning.
Good morning. And our regular contributor, Fred Matthews.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good to have all four of you here this week. So much to talk about. Everything from the school board's growing fight with the city, will they sue, to a slew of public officials in trouble, and more. We'll get to all of it in a moment. But our top story this morning, the city of Jacksonville says it will pay up to $233.3 million. That includes $208 million in hard money to Jaguars owner Shad Khan's big new Lot J development next to TIAA Bank Field. Khan wants to spend $450 million to develop the space around the Jaguar Stadium. This tentative deal approved by Mayor Curry would be the most cash-rich incentives package ever funded by Jacksonville taxpayers. Now, under the deal, the city will kick in a boatload of incentives. In return, Khan's development company will build an entertainment district of bars, condos, office space, restaurants, and an outdoor stage. We're going to begin the hour with a closer look and your calls. What do you think of the Lot J deal? What do you think of the taxpayer money going toward the deal? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Dan Scanlon, let's begin with you. This is the most generous incentive package the city has ever awarded. Your thoughts?
Well, first of all, obviously part of this plan is going to happen very soon, getting rid of the Hart Expressway ramp, which means all the traffic will be going right by all of these facilities. Now, we were talking about this months ago on this, that you want, obviously, traffic when you're building lots of retail and stuff. Now you're going to have restaurants, bars, retail, condos, hotels, entertainment venues, and every single commuter that goes by there, every single passenger is going to have to go right by all of it and right there. Ooh, let's stop. So they're building their own audience, and they're giving this beautiful vista from Daly's Place all the way to the river. And the drawing I've got in front of me is stunning if it happens. Other joke here is if the JEA does get sold, suddenly the city can use that money to clear its debt, and it has the money to establish new debt to pay for this. So there's really no major load on the city's funding if you've got billions that you can make yourself debt-free with.
That's right. And we'll get to the JEA news in a moment. I don't think I even put it in the script. There's so many headlines we got to get to. But Ann Schindler, you know, for years now, we've heard from Shad Khan that he's going to develop the area around the stadium. Finally now, it seems the city has a deal. This will shift the energy east from downtown over here toward this area of the urban core around the football stadium. What does that mean for the rest of downtown, do you think?
Well, for us over at First Coast News, I guess it means we're going to have a new downtown entertainment district at our doorstep. But I think the mayor is counting on building enthusiasm in this area and sort of revitalizing an area that, like the east side, has been quiet other than game time. You know, this where these studios are as well. I guess it's going to depend on how much the community really rallies behind this idea. I mean, Aaron Bowman was telling us yesterday, you know, it's a great thing to have a
city
developer come into your community and want to spend $500 million to, you know, put in a new project. And I guess they're counting on that generating in its own kind of thrill. But it is obviously a big chunk of change. And as Dan said, right now, it's not clear where the city's going to get, you know, even $1 million to or $100 million to put into, you know, kind of developing this project. Where would that come from?
Right. Where will the money come from? Let's talk about the city's coffers. As Dan said, Giorgio, we also are hearing this week from JEA that it's time to talk in earnest about privatizing the utility, Florida Power and Light, as expressing interest in acquiring JEA. This is controversial, of course, for any number of reasons, which we've talked about a lot on this program. Mayor Curry is saying that if JEA were to be sold, the city could essentially be debt-free.
And a lot of the folks that are working for JEA are concerned about what their status is going to be. They're concerned about their pensions. They're concerned about all of this stuff that's going on. And it's not a good look. It's disturbing when it's tied to all of these other initiatives that are happening at the same time, as Dan mentioned. I mean, this is seems to be a very coordinated sort of effort on all fronts.
And by that, you mean all of these threads coming together at once. The Lot J announcement, the turn in positioning around JEA. And so reading all of these tea leaves, Fred Matthews, City Hall is looking to do a lot of big things very quickly, it seems.
Every mayor, every single one, especially after the Godbold era, has always sought to build something, to leave something in his own image in this case, and this is no different. Look, elections have consequences. We're now at a point where you just re-elected this mayor. There is nothing you can do about what he says he wants to do. In the interview he gave a couple of days ago, he finally gave an interview about this issue. He basically came out and said he's in support of the JEA sale. Whereas before the election, oh, I don't know, maybe not, I think so. Now we can pay for it. We can pay for everything we want to do with this. We can tear it down, and then guess what? There's maybe only two votes that would be in opposition to any of these deals on the city council, and we, the citizenry, can only sit back and watch, because you just re-elected this guy and you gave him unbridled power to do it. And it's going to get done.
Well, I mean, we would have a voice in a JEA sale, but of course that is a little bit incentivized now by the proposal they have, which would give, you know, ratepayers a kickback, essentially, for each and every utility function that they buy into. You know, you get $300 or whatever for water, for sewer, for electric. Yeah. So there is a kind of a quid pro quo there.
Well, remember, too, that also a little thing that slipped out this week from our general counsel and a few others. The vote that the council said that would give the citizens the right to vote on this was only a straw vote. It doesn't really mean anything. You
right,
really don't have any say in it.
Let's weigh the argument. The mayor is saying if we sell JEA, we eliminate the city's debt, getting up to $3 billion. The con argument is you're killing the goose that laid the golden egg. JEA generates 100 plus million to the city's general fund each year. Employees could lose their jobs. Rates could go up. And so Dan Scanlon, you know, as Fred said, yes, the public theoretically gets to weigh in on this, but do they really?
I don't know about that. All I can tell you is I've noticed an increase in Florida Power and Light ads on TV of late. Someone's even tweeted, gee, I wonder why. FPNL actually does service into southern St. Johns County, so they're not an unknown entity in this listening area. And the golden egg is certainly, if we become the only debt-free city in the country, that's another blue ribbon to wear and show how great we manage our city, quote unquote. And then we have the funds available to do other development, which would then make a very nice package of goodies as the mayor leaves office.
Okay, and our lines are jammed because it's been that kind of week in Duval. What do you think about all of the news from Lot J to JEA and more? We will begin with Marlena in Arlington. Marlena, good morning. Turn your radio down. Yeah. Go ahead.
Just sorry about that. Good morning, guys. So basically, my question, it has to do with the Shad Khan issue and what we're doing with the actual stadium. Are we looking at how much money is actually going to generate? Because based on how much cities and municipalities have given to developers, especially sports developers, and what's happened around sports complexes, it's shown that they don't actually generate the revenue for the city to compensate for the massive tax credits that they're given, as well as the amount of money that cities come out of their coffers straight into these different franchises. So I'm curious, him saying he wants to develop all this, Is there a concrete number of how much we're going to get as a kickback?
Yeah, Marlena, thanks for that. The city's been vague about that. And that's always the controversy, Giorgio, when cities kick out these kinds of wildly generous incentives. Is there really a return on investment?
That's a good question that hasn't been answered. And even more disturbing in our case is the opportunity cost, because that's money that could be used to develop the real downtown. I mean, a lot of this has been pitched as downtown development. The sports complex is not downtown, you know, almost a mile and a half away from downtown. So what we're doing is we're sinking all that money there. We don't know how it's going to generate revenue in the future. What we do know is that we're going to hollow out the real downtown. We're knocking down the landing, knocking down all these buildings. They're going to get emptier and emptier.
Let's talk about the landing for a moment in the context of this. The Metropolitan Park, which sits right next to WJCT, is restricted by the National Park Service from development. So when we look at the renderings for Shad Khan's vision for Lot J around the stadium, it includes development on the former Metropolitan Park site. Theoretically, to do that, you would have to do a land swap, set up green space elsewhere. If you wanted to develop on the Metropolitan Park site, one that has emerged is that the city looks to create green space at the site of the former Jacksonville Landing, so that they can develop Metropolitan Park, that parcel.
Well, you look at it, I ate at a restaurant downtown last week, and I'm realizing I'm looking across the street at green grass where the courthouse used to be. Next to it is green grass where the old City Hall used to be. We now, at the Times Union, work out of the Wells Fargo building, and we overlook the landing, which will be also green space. Three huge plots of grass within the next year along the St. Johns River. There's your swap, if that's what you're saying.
And the irony of that is that we're even losing revenue with the exit of Welcome to Rockville. And so that should be, I mean, this sports complex area is not on the ascent. I mean, in reality, it's going to be closed off, and it's going to be making money for certain people and excluding others.
ROI.
Well, do we know that? Just to give this a full discussion, do we know that? How have other cities fared with these kinds of developments? Philadelphia, St. Louis, the development company that's going to be doing this.
I mean, I'll tell you, the folks that work in our office that have come from those markets are really enthusiastic about those places as a destination. But, you know, it's not a zero-sum game. I mean, there will be a cost. For instance, you look at places like the Florida Theater, which a couple of years ago was, you know, that's where Fleet Foxes played when they came to town. Well, they're more and more showing movies and kind of civic events because now you have Daly's Place. You've got the arena. Now there's going
to
be the live facility coming in. So, you know, there is a limited market in Jacksonville for these kinds of venues.
That's kind of my question, too. We already have two live arenas in the sports complex, Daly's Place and ViStar Veterans Arena. Now we're adding a third.
Well, we're not adding a third. This is being added by a private entity that's taking over public land. And keep in mind, ROI is not a concern of government. It's only a matter of balancing the books. When this is being discussed about how we're going to pay for it, it's only being discussed about how we're going to pay down our debt. It is not about, in governmentese, about how we're going to make a profit.
Well, apparently we will be getting some. The city will be getting some revenue after a certain point on the parking, of which there appears to be 1,300 spots allocated here. Now, I don't know how that compares to service parking.
It won't be a profit.
No,
all right,
but it's money.
And let's take a few more calls. Laura is on the south side. Hi, Laura. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I'll try to be concise. I'm really frustrated at a couple of these topics. Several weeks ago, a couple months ago, I received an email survey. I believe it was conducted by the city or by UNF on their behalf, asking voters what they thought of these questions. And then I saw the results published in the media, where overwhelmingly Jacksonville citizens did not want JEA sold. And also they want to support the half-cent sales tax for the schools. And so as a voter, I'm really feeling kind of cheated here that we've expressed our opinion and the city council and the mayor are just ignoring it and basically doing whatever they want. Second point real quick is that Shad Khan's a great guy, but he's really rich. Why do we have to give him $208 million for his project that he's going to make profit off of? I just don't understand that at all.
Thank you, Laura. And we're getting emails expressing similar sentiments. Here's an email from Vicky. The stadium project is frustrating to me. Where will the parking be located? We can spend that amount of money, but we can't allow a $1 million school vote? We would mitigate Metro Park with the land at the landing to give the homeless another downtown park, but no more shelters for them. We will sell JEA to further Curry's political career. This is madness, she says. And so callers and those emailing in are expressing frustration that in their view, the will of the voters is not being expressed. Voters that have been surveyed overwhelmingly do not want JEA to be sold, and they are in strong support of a half-cent sales tax referendum for schools. Let me comment on that briefly, because earlier this week, Duval County School Board Chair Lori Hershey told us that the city of Jacksonville's involvement in the struggle to get a half-cent sales tax referendum on the ballot this fall, in her words, feels like extortion. She also questioned the real agenda of opponents to the referendum. It would pay for badly needed improvements to local schools. Hershey made the comments on this show earlier this week. Let's listen.
Well, I would say it feels more like extortion as well as being held hostage. The question that needs to be answered is, will the voters be able to decide, and if so, when?
Okay, so let's talk about this for a moment. The school board is still pushing forward with their intention to get a referendum before the voters, despite considerable opposition from City Hall. At the same time, we learned this week that the mayor's recently retired chief administrator and his partner, a political consultant to the mayor, offered their help to the school board to get the referendum before the voters to the tune of $12,000 a month if they push the referendum back from this year until 2020. And they promise an upfront payment to local charter schools of $150 million. And so this is breaking, as all of this other news is breaking. Ann Schindler, what about Hershey's comment? It's extraordinary to hear the head of the school board say, the city is extorting us.
Yeah, I noticed that Senator Gibson also tweeted the definition of shakedown in response to this news story this week. There's a sentiment that, you know, the school board is being, that their authority at the very least is being appropriated by city officials to some extent, and that their will is being manipulated. The payoff to charter schools is controversial. I mean, this is the tax is supposed to be paying for public schools in disrepair that, you know, don't have functioning air conditioning, that don't have, you know, proper facilities. And there's such support in the city right now for charter schools among sort of the donor classes, if you will, that they are now demanding that a big payment be given to charter schools. I mean, that's the philosophy. That's what would carry this tax forward. And that's what these two, Curry associates were basically telling Lori Hershey. So it's a conundrum. I mean, the school district is trying to prioritize schools that are in actual crisis as opposed to just, you know, facilitating development at charter schools. And that seems to be the sticking point.
And as school board member Warren Jones, who's been involved in city government forever, told us at the Times Union recently, he said Musa actually called him last month and made suggestions that basically he and an unidentified business partner should lead the effort to push that referendum to 2020, promise charter schools an upfront $150 million payment if the sales tax were to pass, and a few other things. So that's the push that seems to be out there, and charter schools seem to want to be part of this whole project.
Right. You mean Sam Musa.
Sam Musa.
The former chief administrator.
Well, at the time he had not yet retired as the chief of staff, and he's been in public life before, and he's been also head of public works. So Sam is very much involved in the pulse of the city, both private and in public.
Hershey also said on this program she believes the push for money for charters, which she told us on this program she thinks is now edging up to closer to $250 million of a half-cent sales tax referendum. She believes that the aggressive push there is to make sure that more money goes to IDA schools, which are going to be setting up in this community in a few years. They are designated as schools of hope by the state, and are popping up in neighborhoods where there are failing schools. And so that was another wrinkle to this matter. Giorgio.
Yeah, I don't want to get lost in the weeds of the issue, because at its heart, it's a very basic issue. The school board has the constitutional authority to authorize this referendum. They exercise that discretion, and City Hall did everything it could to obstruct, and it's continuing to do that. So I think we need to be clear that this is a question of constitutional authority to ask the voters something, and the voters are going to get their chance to express themselves in the referendum. And what City Hall is doing is preventing the voters from having their say. And various city council members have been saying, oh, well, my constituents have not been consulted, or they don't know. Well, let the referendum go forward. And if the voters don't like it, they can vote it down.
And the irony of the city council members saying such a thing is that there are two city council districts to each school board districts. They are the same constituents. They're the same constituents who voted the city council into office. They're the same people who voted the school board into office. So this is another fallacy that's out there with this. But guess what, folks? It is a bit of extortion here. There's no need now, since the supervisor of elections have indicated he can't get it on the ballot for this year anyway. So there's no need for the school board to take this contract from Musa et al. They simply should take their chances and move forward with it. But at this point, unless the mayor waves his wand, and that's who's controlling this activity, unless the mayor waves his wand, it's not going to happen anytime soon, and they're going to have to pay the 20% to Caesar.
I've been told there is the potential of a December special election if the August 13th vote were to occur by city council. The potential is you could do it within those 120-plus days and set it up. But again, special elections are notoriously very, very low turnout, and you're talking about Christmas holiday times. Who's going to want to go out?
But it's not going to move. It's simply we have a strong mayor form of government. Again, it really kicked into high gear from the Godbo years, who's, by the way, in strong opposition to what this mayor is doing.
As he told us.
But we have a strong mayor form of government. Everything emanates from that floor. And until the mayor waves his wand and says, okay, I'm not going to oppose it, let's go forth with it, those members on the council are not going to move.
Let's take some calls about that. Susan is in Mandarin. Hi, Susan. Good morning.
I was wondering, since the city council is asking the school board all these questions at the last minute, and the school board hired a consultant in 2018, and I'm wondering your thoughts on, is the city council making the same mistake with JEA? JEA has hired a consultant now, so it seems like now is the time for the city council to start asking questions. If the sale is proposed, city council will have to vote on it, and then the voters will have to vote on it. But is it going to be a last-minute thing where they've ruined JEA so much that we'll have no choice but to vote yes? And my other question is, a caller mentioned the UNF poll, and I would like to call out to UNF and see if y'all agree that they should ask people, when they polled people, if they voted in the last unitary election where Mayor Curry was elected by 14% of the registered voters. Thank you, and thanks for doing this.
All right, Susan, thank you. And so whether it's the referendum for schools or the sale of JEA, those are the two really hot-button issues right now. The question becomes, do members of the city council feel more pressure from the fourth floor of City Hall or from their constituents?
I mean, you know, I think that right now the feeling is that the momentum is with the mayor. You know, his political consultant helped, I think, on 8 of those city council members' election campaigns. So there seems to be at least a somewhat of a good feeling, friendship and sort of an affinity between the fourth floor and the members of the city council.
And if I may add that the school board referendum issue is one that for a while had City Hall on its heels. And I think just the public outcry is such that's an issue that the people can win if they keep pushing.
And of course, what we have here that started, again, these things start, have a start time. The school board, it is elected, of course, independently. But we're at a point now where the independently elected school board members have really no relationship with the city council members, as it was when the school board was all male. And there was just one female on it up until, the late 80s. Now it is predominantly female. And they are all elected on their own. They don't have this political relationship, with the exception, I think, of Cheryl Grimes, who has been in government a while. But they have no relationship, no political relationship. So there's not that discussion that used to take place at the old Diamond Head restaurant down to St. John's, where you can go after city council meeting and school board meeting and meet and talk. There's none of that anymore. And that's part of the issue here. That's why the pressure has to be on. That's why the Constitutional Revision Commission is still going to take up the idea of
making
it under the mayor.
And let's talk about that. The Revision Commission is meeting, and at the top of their agenda is to bring up, as they did 10 years ago, the discussion of having an appointed rather than an elected school board. Despite many efforts over the years to get elected onto the school board, candidates that would better reflect the agenda of some of the issues we've been discussing, grassroots, lightly funded candidates have repeatedly been elected to the school board. And so this community seems to express time and time again that that's what they would prefer to see on the school board. But as Fred pointed out, they aren't part of this political power structure that's driving all of the controversial issues that we're discussing on the show today.
I mean, the thing about an appointed versus an elected school board, I mean, you know, as Giorgio was saying, when you take away their taxing authority, you basically obviate any need to usurp them and take away their elected, you know, position, because you've essentially taken away their one single authority, their, you know, their mm-hmm. one ability to execute their own will has mm-hmm. been usurped. So, I mean, you could talk about an appointed versus an elected school board, but they've effectively done that by not allowing them to put this taxing measure before voters.
And that brings the next question, which is, will the Duval County School Board sue over this matter, even though the city's lead attorney has told them they are not permitted to sue? The chairwoman of the school board, Lori Hershey, on this program the other day said, if mediation on this fails, we will take legal action, following on the heels of the school board in Clay County, which is also suing their county commission over this exact same matter, the ability to go before the voters and levy a tax to pay for school improvements. It's noteworthy to point out that in St. John's County, voters there overwhelmingly approved a referendum like that to make sure that school buildings are in good condition.
And they have an A-plus school rating in St. John's County, whereas there's issues in Clay as well as Duval County. And both of their government elected body, City Council Commission, have wanted many questions answered, as if they don't believe that their school boards know what they're talking about their own facilities.
And someone's going to have to sue. I mean, our consolidated form makes it a little bit more complicated than Clay, but there's an avenue also for private citizens to sue over this. I mean, someone has to do something because, as Ann was saying, this issue ties directly in, and as Fred was saying, with what the CRC is going to be doing. City Hall is trying to chasten the school board now, and then they're going to make the school board appointed next year is what they're going to try to do. So the heavy lifting is being done now, and now is the time that voters and constituents for these city council members can really put some heat on. And that's why I'm kind of like a one-trick pony with this school board referendum matter. I think this is of the utmost importance. I think we need to really champion this issue and just keep it moving forward, because this is the front lines right now.
Linda is in Bay Meadows. Hi, Linda. Good morning.
Good morning. God, so many things have gone on, but there's this thread of, you know, Mayor Curry is a strong mayor, quote unquote. I just wish he would have had the guts to lay out his agenda and sell it to the citizens instead of the subterfuge. Oh, I don't know what I want for JEA. Of course I want JEA because I need that money. Of course I negotiated with Sean Khan. Of course I negotiated the landing when they were in litigation. I don't understand that. So I think the citizenry, some people did elect him. I just wish if he thought this was a good idea, he should have laid it out, and the media should have dug in. I know you asked him for things, but this information was out there. We needed to know that there was a cabal behind this situation that they were putting together, and now we don't seem to have an option except to sue the city, sue them into the ground. Thank you.
And don't forget that the mayor issued a video news release on the Lot J development. There was no news conference where he could take or answer questions. He has only taken some questions now from one TV station locally, I believe, since then.
Well, he granted some interviews yesterday around, but he's been very selective. And I mean, I think it's worth mentioning that he's been, and JEA have been shutting out our city's daily paper, which I think is really a bad decision. I think anytime that you've got city leaders refusing to discuss like important matters with the city's daily newspaper, that's very troubling, and everybody should be concerned about that.
Fake news.
Okay, and so what about, let me ask you both. Here's a tweet. Meanwhile, the school board needs to sue. The supervisor of elections will need to deal with whatever the judge orders. We may have a strong mayoral form of government here, but we still have checks and balances. Will individuals band together and sue over this? I think, as a caller mentioned a moment ago, and you ran an editorial in your publication, Giorgio, where a contributor to Folio is asking for a recall petition for this mayor, which is politically very unlikely to ever take place.
It is far-fetched, but there is a mechanism for it. That's Attorney Terry Bork, who's been working with us on these issues. And he was motivated by this referendum issue, and that just kind of that got his attention. He said as soon as the general counsel issued this opinion, quasi-opinion, that kind of gummed up the works at the very start, Terry said, this is, first of all, this is bizarre. This is bizarre law is what it is. And that precedent is being used now in Clay County. And so, but to go back to the recall, yeah, there's a mechanism. It can be done in theory.
Kari in Neptune Beach. Kari, good morning.
Hi. Yeah. I was just wondering if you guys could be really specific about what we as voters and parents need to do to let our voices be heard. Is there a email address, a website where we can write to just en masse to let them know that we are not happy with not letting our voices be heard about this half-cent sales tax referendum?
Well, this is before the city council. So, you know, I would encourage anyone who is vested in this issue to go to coj.net, click on city council, contact your city council reps or any issue.
And August 13th, during that next council meeting, there will be open mic time where you can give up to 3 minutes of conversation.
And most of the city council members are on Twitter or on Facebook, so they have public platforms where you can call them out as at will.
Yeah, I mean, there's at this point, there's only two council members that we can note, Garrett Dennis and possibly Matt Carlucci, that have voiced any kind of opposition, or at least let's wait and hold up on this. That Matt has been true to it since when he was running for re-election this time and since he's been in office. COJ.net. Hit government, and that's your pathway to it, and attend the city council committee meetings. You're a constituent. But if you don't participate, citizens, the city council member that you elected is going to go with what is said on the fourth floor.
All right. Speaking of the city council, speaking of public officials, quickly we're going to do a roundup of city officials in trouble. Mm. Lots of them. Current and former public officials in this area made headlines this week alone, beginning with Katrina Brown. A judge says former city council member Brown can represent herself in her federal fraud trial, although we advised against it. Brown goes to trial this month related to charges around a federally backed loan for her family to build a barbecue sauce factory. Ann Schindler, you've been covering this. She faces 37 felony counts.
Yeah, it was a strange moment in court yesterday. I mean, the judge literally said to her, I don't know how to impress upon you how this is the most consequential decision of your adult life. And, you know, he offered an analogy. He said, if your house was on fire tonight, and a serious fire, would you call 911 or would you grab a garden hose? So he's basically saying, represent yourself at your own peril. It is so daunting. I mean, federal court has a 90%+ conviction rate already when you have proper representation. But the idea that somebody who has no legal background is going to try to defend themselves is scary.
Absolutely,
really.
Yeah. And she, along with another former city council member, Reggie Brown, no relation, are both charged over this alleged scam. And so as we follow that trial, we also want to touch on another dubious public official story. Clay County Sheriff Daryl Daniels is facing challengers to his reelection. This is due to an FDLE investigation surrounding his extramarital affair with a subordinate officer. And Daniels is increasingly embattled. He allegedly had an affair with a woman he supervised when he was chief of the jail for the JSO. Giorgio, you've been writing about this one.
Yeah, we have Susan Armstrong down there that's doing great work. And we're hearing that there might be an intervention very soon.
What does that mean?
Well, it means that we might hear more about it today.
Okay.
But it looks like that FDLE investigation is starting to bear fruit.
He's still in office, though.
Are they going to stop him from wearing that cowboy hat?
He is drawing more challengers.
He's drawing challengers.
Blood in the water, I think.
He's got fellow Republicans challenging Daniels, Ben Carroll, Harold Rutledge, and former FDLE agent Mike Taylor. He has drawn three active Republican challengers.
In June, he said he planned to run again. He has not done so because I checked the clerk site yesterday. But obviously, developments this week, there is a Facebook site called Save the Clay County Sheriff's Office that had some interesting posts this week about his apparent personal life. And again, you take a look at the boilerplate that Sierra Daniels filed in her divorce. She checked the box that said the marriage is irretrievably broken. So I would guess Sierra is the girlfriend. Sorry, who quit this week before she got her hearing? I'm juggling a lot
straight.
Here. But the bottom line is, she filed it in Duval County.
We are doing our best to keep all of these stories straight here on the roundtable.
She filed it in Duval County, so the chances are that she's no longer living anywhere near Clay County
at
this point.
You don't say.
I mean, it's just astounding. Our heads are literally spinning this week from all of these stories that have happened. So we are doing our best to break it all down for all of you out there, the listeners. Now, there's another one we need to talk about.
Another one?
Former public defender Matt Shirk apparently gave away guns, computers, and money from his public office after he was ousted from office back in 2016 due to corruption charges. The Times Union is reporting that a new Florida Auditor General's report out this week says Shirk used state employees to staff his personal nonprofit. He assigned attorneys in the public defender's office to work at his personal fundraising events. He also wiped hard drives from office computers, then gave them away. He even gave away 9 guns from the public defender's office, which it's made it difficult to trace them. The current public defender, Charles Cofer, was elected basically to clean up the mess that was left in this office as Shirk became embroiled in controversy when he was the public defender for the Fourth Circuit. There's been no comment from Shirk. Also, no comment from the state attorney's office. Will they file any charges against Matt Shirk? He apparently also still owes the state of Florida money related to his alleged mismanagement of public funds.
And a lot
there's
of this happened.
There's a lot here.
A lot of this happened after he lost the election, including doubling the salaries of a number of his staff members who either resigned or were fired as Mr. Cofer took over.
Why did the PDs need guns?
Investigators are attorneys. They're law enforcement. Same as state attorney's office has investigators. So that's not a surprise to me. But 9 weapons out there, and the claim as to who they went to is also a little concerning.
Now, when Shirk was the public defender, he got in hot water for installing a private shower at the public defender's office.
Well, that's understandable.
Inviting young women to shower with him in the public defender's office. That
save
was just
water.
His wife. His wife came downtown and burst into the public defender's office when she got wind of this. I mean, so whether it's Shirk, Daniels, the Browns, a number of public officials that we've been talking about all through the hour, as Fred said, elections have consequences. And so, you know, this community is grappling with the consequences of who we have elected on a number of fronts to represent us.
I mean, it's easy to do it. I mean, there was if you just look at the Katrina Brown issue, for instance, it was so easy for folks to get angry at Pat Felder, who was the incumbent at that time. And some of us are still roiling from that statue at the end of A. Philip Randolph Boulevard.
Pat Lockett Felder was on the city council. She erected a statue of herself in her district. Yeah.
But you almost,
can forget that one.
Yeah, but you almost hail back to that because during the campaign, Ms. Felder did point out that there was a financial issue with Ms. Brown and this barbecue business that her father had. And of course, once you get elected to office, the scrutiny gets bigger. And this is the consequence of that, that the scrutiny got bigger, and Katrina, unfortunately, is going to pay the full price.
But I mean, I think people are saying, with Shirk, why isn't there that scrutiny? You know, right now, I think even if he's not investigated by the state attorney's office, or if they don't open something, the Florida bar is going to have to act. I mean, he's still practicing law. You know, one of the notes in this in this article talks about how he went and spent $800 a night at a hotel in New York after he lost election to go to a conference on immigration law, which is what he practices now in his private practice, now that he's not in office. So, I mean, I think that clearly there's some ethical issues that the bar should be addressing.
Would the bar take away his license to practice? That's a legitimate question.
But he does have a fine of $5,200 and some change right now. Is that what he's owed? Is that the thing he got from the last disciplinary activity? That's what he's owed
kind
to
of
the
chump
office?
Change, I think, compared to what he's being, you know, what he used in those final days in office of public money.
Even a lot of the numbers quoted in the Times Union article are not, in the grander scheme of things, a lot of cash. But the fact that they were done, any private citizen can file a complaint with the Florida bar against an attorney, correct?
Yep.
So obviously here we are talking about things. Someone could file a complaint, and if enough do, then it's got to get looked at.
But from officialdom, yeah. The criminal justice system, there's been no movement other than this Florida Auditor General's report.
Well, there was, you know, Cervone, the state attorney in the central part of Florida, did, you know, a grand jury investigation.
There was a grand jury investigation.
They chose not to, you know, indict him. And they recommended that he be removed from office. And Governor Rick Scott declined to do that. He said, I'm going to leave it up to the voters.
Yes. And then the voters ousted Shirk, elected Charles Cofer. And so, man, it's been quite an hour with all of you this morning. We have time for a lightning round, though, given all that, which is amazing. What else caught your eye this week, guys?
How about all the shootings and the murders? And we're closing in on 100 homicides for this year, which would beat last year at this point.
Unfortunately, with all the other news, that has been crowded out, and it needs to be. We need to keep the focus on that.
Yeah.
No, we're going to restart the task force. It looks like the task force had ended at the end of the last city council president's term. There's discussion about restarting this task force, but the current president says, hold up a minute. Let's not talk about, we can talk about having the task force, but we need to have the task force talk about how they're going to pay for what the task force is going to do. So we have to move on with that, because we've already paid for this true crime. What is that thing we got? The true crime, prevent crime. Crime, whatever that is, and the issue is still
cure
the same.
Violence. Cure
there
violence.
You go. Cure, yeah, that thing from Chicago.
All right. And speaking of violence, oh my goodness. Last but not least, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and ridiculous from the week. Luckily, never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now. Only in Florida, the shark bite edition. Only in Florida does a professional surfer get bitten by a shark and go have a brewski at the bar on the beach rather than go to the hospital. This happened in Jack's Beach, made national news as pro surfer Frank O'Rourke was out on the pier last Saturday when a shark latched onto his arm and got a good bite in. He decided that he was okay, though, and just kind of went and got a drink.
Medicinal
treatment. He never made it, in fact, to the hospital. Berger told reporters he probably could have used a stitch or two. You can see the images on social media. It's a severe bite, so what was he thinking?
Just brave the waves, I guess.
Brave the waves. I mean, you know, it scared me because of this bacteria thing. I'm scared to go down to the beach now and get a cut on a rock.
Oh, you'll be fine, Fred.
Yeah, right.
You'll be fine.
Well, Fred, I'll see you at the beach. Maybe you and I can go to the Lemon Bar one night.
That's where we'll be.
I bet that's where Giorgio will be.
We'll be up there on the deck.
All right. Giorgio Valentino, Fred Matthews, Ann Schindler, and Dan Scanlon. So good to have you all here. Thanks, guys. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
And up next, some financial ABCs for students heading off to college in a few weeks. We'll be right back. Pacific Palisade, inside, outside, you send an over Yansa.
Wayne Hogan of the Tara Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan. A mini stroke, or TIA, happens when blood is briefly blocked from the brain. It often warns of a looming stroke. and requires immediate medical attention.
Learn more at waynehogan.law.
ServPro of Jacksonville South and Arlington remind you to act fast, whether it's water, mold, or fire damage. ServPro of Jacksonville South, 721-2230. Like it never even happened.
The fight to ban assault weapons in Florida. I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup.
This Friday, activists are pushing for a proposed constitutional amendment on the 2020 Florida ballot that would ban possession of assault weapons in the state. Attorney General Ashley Moody says she's opposed. We'll have a closer look.
Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Friday at noon on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm Ira Flatow. This week on Science Friday, a spike in deforestation puts the Amazon rainforest and the planet at risk. Plus, 50% of the oxygen that we breathe, well, it comes from slime. A look at the tremendous importance of algae for the health of our planet. Climate science takes center stage this week on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 3 here on 89.9 WJCT.
Osama bin Laden's heir is reportedly dead. Was he being groomed to follow in his father's footsteps? And how did he die? Also, America sanctions Iran's top diplomat, and the U.S.-China trade war escalates. The Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, students of all ages are heading back to school in just a few weeks. According to the College Board, average fees related to going to college range from about $3,000 a year to $35,000, depending on which school you choose. Here in Northeast Florida, Jack's Federal Credit Union is working to make the cost of attending college more manageable for five students. The credit union recently awarded scholarships to five local students, totaling $2,500 each. Joe Nolan is the president and CEO of Jack's Federal Credit Union. He's got two kids in high school himself, and he's here now to talk about the scholarships and also some tips for preparing for back to school. Hey, Joe, good morning.
Well, good morning, and thank you for having me.
Thanks for being with us. So five lucky students each got a scholarship. How did you select the winners?
You know, well, first off, I want to go back in time. We've done a scholarship program for a number of years, and we gave one scholarship out for $1,000. But Jack's Federal, I mean, being here since 1935 and trying to make a difference in people's lives, we decided we're going to give one per county that we serve. So we actually gave out $2,500 in scholarships this year. We posted on Facebook and social media, and we actually allowed all students to apply in these five counties. And we selected one winner from every county that we serve.
Wow, those are some lucky students. And they're going from everywhere to Florida State, to St. John's River State College, Flagler College, some other places. And so people need to keep their eye out for these kinds of scholarship opportunities. And then going beyond that, what are the budgeting basics you want every college-bound student to focus on this year?
You know, one of the things that people need to learn at a young age and apply this in college, and then actually even as an adult, it really helps them, a formula that I call the 50-30-20 formula. And this formula is 50% of whether it's income that you get as a part-time job or allowance from your parents, or even if the scholarship money, 50% of it, apply that to your the things you must pay for, rent, food, gas. And another 30% for things that maybe you want, but you actually don't need, going to a movie, a new, you know, shopping or something like that. And then 20% for savings or paying down debt. So 50, 30, 20. If you learn that and you start applying that, actually even before you get to college, it's going to help benefit you mm-hmm. when you become an adult later on as well.
That's a good way to look at it. You also have some tools you want to share to help parents monitor their students' spending when they leave home.
Yeah, very important. So, you know, there's a lot of tools that we offer, but I want to step back and say this. The tool that's free for anybody is parents talking to their children. That is, it's hard, it's difficult to do, but it is critical for you to help them be successful financially for the rest of their lives. But the tools that we offer, you know, we have checking accounts that you can actually link to a parent's account. So you can actually fund them. You can actually monitor their account and fund it. We also offer secured credit cards, which will allow a student or a child to have a smaller balance, but a something they manage without getting out of control.
Yeah. The key is to start teaching them those management skills before they leave home. And what about when they get to campus and they're bombarded with credit card offers? When I was in college, that got me in trouble because it looked so appealing. And you get in debt pretty quickly, and then it's hard to get out.
You're right. So maybe you remember this. So I remember going to college and walking through campus, and there was these different credit card companies, and they would give you a free shirt if you'd apply, or they'd give you a Frisbee or a bunch of plastic cups. And if you're not careful, you'll have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 credit cards. So the thing is this, when you turn 18, you are going to get marketed by these credit card companies. But it's so important that you are thoughtful about what you do, because you have to build strong credit and strong credit score that's going to go beyond. This credit will go beyond college. So it gets back to having those conversations with those students before they even get there. Do you need one card? Do you need two? I've always recommended people to have really two credit cards in most cases when you're younger. You have your primary one, and you have your backup one for if the primary one's not working, there's something wrong. But you don't need three credit cards as a student. You don't need four credit cards.
Do you recommend parents add their college student to their credit card account or not?
So I that's a great way, particularly when you're younger. But as an authorized user, some students just don't have that credit. But I can tell you, in my household, my son, who is a senior, his credit card is our credit card, and it allows us to, when he uses it, it triggers alerts to us. So we know where he's at, and we know that he's spending too much time at Sonic or McDonald's.
Or wherever they're spending time.
Yes.
Well, kudos to the students chosen by Jack's Federal Credit Union, 5 local scholarship winners. Keep your eye out for other scholarship opportunities. We certainly need them as our kids get ready to go off to college. Joe Noland, he is the president and CEO of Jack's Federal Credit Union. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Well, that is our show. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Her kids are not anywhere near ready to go to college yet. Michelle Corum is our director. Her kids are done with college. Where does that leave me? I still have to pay for college. How are we going to do this? Send me your emails with thoughts about that and anything else to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And make sure to tune in to 89.9 today at noon for the Florida Roundup, our statewide look at the biggest stories from across Florida. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. I'm Melissa Ross. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.